It is Saturday, December 12th. December 1st, 2012. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, your news, the news of the week with a few of the geeks. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. Today in the Arum with me is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a software engineer and political junkie. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning.
And Mr. Alex Leas, an information security analyst. Hi, Alex.
Good morning, Lyle.
So you guys have a lot of news for the week, and I'm very excited. I've missed the show tremendously. I'm so glad to be back. Last week's episode was fantastic. The week before was very good as well, Miles, and it was a pleasure to know that you guys all took care of it. You and Robert Pauly took care of the show while I was gone. I appreciate it so much. Let's jump into
plus
some... Plus or minus the theme song? Yeah, well, I kind of messed up today, too.
It wouldn't be a Miles show without a theme, missing a theme song.
Of course. It's quite all right. So let's, speaking of theme songs, the theme song we used today was from Dave Patera, and of course, we appreciate any theme songs. Today, we are taking your calls with questions and comments in the second half. You're welcome to give us a ring right now if you'd like to get in the queue or wait a little bit. I'll give it the information again, but the phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. And we will give out that information in about 25 minutes when we invite you to call in. So, Alex, what's going on in security area?
All right. Definitely going to start off with a, you know, a little bit of a, I guess, scary kind of story. It's never, you know, always fun to do that. Well, earlier this year at DEF CON, there was an announcement about, as there are typically, about a new hack. And what this hacker kind of came up and was presenting on was a way to circumvent the key card controls that are used in a lot of common hotels, like where you have your hotel and
so
you get
a
little
now,
card, you
yeah.
slide it in a little slot and
like a credit
the door.
Card.
Right. Well, they have a way around it. And he's able to, with off-the-shelf equipment, you can just buy it, you know, at your local electronics store for about $50. He could put together something that basically lets him into a hotel room in a matter of seconds.
Any hotel room.
Any hotel room for a particular
brand
of, yeah. of lock.
It's, what's the flaw?
You know, I'm not. It's some electronic flaw. I haven't read the detail in terms.
So it's probably one of those things like a buffer overload or something like that.
Yeah, or some combination where you're tricking you to think it's in a state it's not, and it you know you can get it into an unlocked state. I mean, basically they're state machines.
It's really funny that even in software development, where the primary focus is to make sure that it's not openable unless you have the code that you can open it. And of course, they're complicated
systems. There's no safe you can't get around.
And of course, those systems are pretty complicated. I've always assumed that there was a whole network infrastructure for those things. But I'm sure that there's different ways that you can run them. You can give them probably just power and then program them to set, you know, to accept the next 500 of these codes. And then the front desk just programs one of those codes in, right? So it could be a situation where it actually has a lot of ability to be accessed. Or it could be networked, of course.
And, I mean, the thing is, that was back, you know, July, August time frame. But there's actually more recent news related to that is in Texas, there actually have been compromises, I mean, actual hotel thefts occurring where they believe that this was used. And one of the really bad things, and they're getting a really bad rap for it, and deservingly so, is Onity, the company that makes the lock that has the vulnerability, actually wants the hotels to pay and buy new locks rather than fix their own flaw for free.
I
or at least a part share. They want
them completely. I think that will change.
This sounds so much like the test screen voting where the voting machines could be hacked and they're saying, no, you can't look at our code. This is
right. Yeah. Except that this is, I think that was probably worse in the sense that it was modifying the political structure. But the lock system being not lockable is kind of a sad situation.
Yeah, so, you know, when you go into a hotel, take a quick look at and see if you can see the manufacturer. It's Onity, O-N-I-T-Y.
We don't like Onity.
Yeah,
okay,
if you see that, ask if you either have another room that doesn't use that lock or find a hotel that does.
Okay, political junkie, what's up in the world of international politics and such?
People noted the day before yesterday that Syria dropped off the internet.
Just the country of Syria left the internet.
Yes.
Not a good thing.
So no servers that were found in Syria were communicating anymore.
Okay.
And except for actually five servers that were associated with malware, but they have since been knocked off as well. And this has been covered in the news, to my knowledge anyway. But what I want to talk about was the geek aspect to it. Like, how hard is it to turn off a country?
Right.
And it depends upon what country you live in and what your infrastructure is like. Because to turn off the internet to to a whole nation requires that any of the service providers that are on the borders that control those telecommunication links be okay with that decision.
Right.
And if you only have a few, which is the case in many authoritarian countries, like, for example, Syria, then you only have to have some influence or threaten a certain number of people, like maybe less than 10 people, to say, yeah, we're going to cut this off now. As opposed to other countries, like in the Western world, the United States comes to mind, almost all of Western Europe, quite a bit of Eastern Europe, as a matter of fact, Australia, Brazil. There are so many connections to the outside world with so many different operators. To get everyone on board would be unlikely, at least without some mention of why it was happening.
Right.
Because the Syria connection went down without any warning. It just someday, one day, people noticed that it wasn't there. And one thing you have to worry about, because say, like, so they were off the internet. What does that mean? Commonly, a country goes off the internet when the leadership, probably in this case, the leader of Syria, was either afraid of messages that were coming through from the outside world, coming in to coordinate efforts for people to make right. attacks upon his position because there's a bloody civil war going on there, or it's cutting it's for PR purposes, cutting off avenues for people to report what's going on before something really bloody and horrible happens.
Sure, sure. So do we know what the case is right now?
We don't yet. However, we do know that the Syrian opposition, the Syrian rebels who are fighting against the central government have been finding avenues to get out of the get information out of the country. And that includes things like satellite telecommunications. Satellite equipment has been smuggled into the country, and so they've been using that. And that's something that isn't easily taken right. down because it is a point to space
sure, sure.
Item. And also, there are Google has set up a thing called voice to Twitter.
Yeah.
And so you're able to call in, dictate a message, and have it show up on a Twitter account.
So the phone systems are still functioning.
The phone systems are still running. Right. And this brings up an interesting aspect, which is the genie now out of the bottle?
Right.
Is now communications in such a way that you cannot cut it off, even if you have an authoritarian government?
Right.
One thing.
And of course, that's the outflow information. The inflow information would still be horrible. I mean, if you're in Syria and you're trying to find out about the world, unless a friend of yours is calling or you can call somebody, it's really hard to receive information.
Or unless they have a satellite feed.
Right. Right. Oh, well, thank you for the, one more thing.
One last aspect to that is in the U.S., there's been legislation that's been bandied about in Congress with regard to an internet kill switch.
Right.
And with this in mind and with what I've described in mind, which is how the technology and commerce and the governments are involved. Because the internet was made with, if there's a problem, then you route around that problem.
Yeah, it's designed to survive.
Right. Someone who puts up legislation saying, we want an internet kill switch in case of emergency. One, it's like, what type of emergency are you talking about that you wouldn't want to have communications?
Right.
And B, you don't really understand what our infrastructure looks like right. if that's what you're planning on.
Right. All right. Well, thanks for the update, Miles. I appreciate that. Syria's offline, and we're not sure why. So what's up with, let me give you a little, no, I'll just jump into the Microsoft AV stuff.
Sure. Well, there's a German antivirus lab called AV Test, and they do tests of the various antivirus and security software that's out there. And in one of their latest tests, Microsoft's security suite with Windows 7 failed their test. Something that you would think is, okay, some things failed. No, they were the only ones that failed, which is not good. But it's the stuff that basically the way they do is they take systems and they load on a bunch of viruses and malware onto it.
Okay.
And they run the different security suites on this, and they try to identify, okay, how many of the viruses did it find?
Right.
And in addition, they also add in scores related to usability for how many programs did it falsely identify as a virus?
Sure, sure. To find out basically how good the software is.
Right.
So AVG failed?
No, it's
I'm sorry, who failed?
It was Microsoft's security suite with the Windows 7 security suite.
Okay, I get what you're saying. So,
AVG, however, their free version, and Viper is another internet security suite. Both of them scored extremely poorly, a full 3 points. And when we're talking points, their scores were 12.5 and 12. Microsoft got 10.5. So when you drop a full 3 points in that range, it's like, you know, a lot of
So you're saying, so did anybody do a really good job of finding all the viruses?
There's actually some that were noted as some of the top winners. You have Bitdefender Internet Security. They're up there at the top. They have been at the top for a while. They scored in the 17-18 range.
And is that
17 range of 18 possible points?
Oh, I see what you're saying. So
we also have F-Secure Internet Security and Kaspersky, which is also getting a lot of momentum both in personal computing, but also in the commercial industry.
Would you mind, because we've been suggesting AVG for quite a while on GeekSpeak in general. I think all of us are in a Mac right now, so we don't deal with viruses very much. Would you mind carrying, you know, the Bitdefender and Kaspersky and the ones that actually did well, and just adding that to the GeekSpeak feed?
Yeah, I'll be sure.
Because I think that's a good thing to know, like the best solution. I've been suggesting for a while now that you just use Microsoft's Essentials. It's kind of insulting to have to use the product that they should have already had the virus. I mean, they should already have it built in anyway, but
that's been a simple solution. Security Essentials is the worst of all of them that they tested.
That's really interesting, because I'd been kind of in the space of that's an easy solution, but not a good one. So are any of these ones Bitdefender or Kaspersky?
Kaspersky.
I'm assuming
Russian company.
Russian company. So Kaspersky or Bitdefender or Kaspersky, a free product, or are these all paid?
You know, I have to double check. I'm not
they're
sure
all
which ones.
They're all paid for.
Yeah.
I think it's one of those things where it makes sense to invest. Yeah, it makes sense to invest, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you got to recognize if you're trying to protect your computer, I don't think they're very expensive.
You're right.
And granted, there's probably an annual subscription fee and all that, but it's probably in the $25 to $50 range per year.
All right. Well, thanks. Miles, you want to tell us about war or getting rid of the signs of war?
One major problem with the trappings of war, if you will, are the mines, the anti-personnel mines that exist long after the war is over. This has been an issue in Southeast Asia. It's been an issue. Basically, every battlefield in the world has these unexploded ordnances. And so how do you deal with them? Well, for some people, it's going out and trying to find them and disabling them yourself. But, you know, that yes, if someone is actively looking for them, you're going to be less likely to detonate it without you wanting to and losing a limb or your life. But it's much better if human life is not involved. So what an Afghan designer has done is taken an object that looks reminiscent of some play toys. And you take some piece of bamboo, all coming from a central spoke, make a sphere where the outside edges are these circles.
Okay.
And it's about 71 kilograms, so
heavy.
150 pounds. Yeah. Not that bad for how large it is.
How large is it?
190 centimeters in diameter.
Okay.
So a breeze can make it move around.
So it's about the height of a person and about the weight of a person.
Right? Yes.
Okay.
And
it's a sphere.
Right. And it has these circular pads all around, which means that it can catch the wind.
Right.
And so you basically have this large, spiky tumbleweed.
Right.
And the idea is that if you have an open area, like is the case in many Afghan deserts or the like, that it just gets blown around until it runs
until
over
until it literally
mine,
gets blown around.
Yeah. But it requires no power. It just blowing around.
Right, and probably not that expensive.
Very inexpensive.
Yeah.
That was one
of the So the idea would be you'd go, well, this area might have landmines, fence it off to protect people, and then throw a few of these things in this multi-mile area and let them roll around for a few years.
Yeah,
hopefully they'll blow up. And
the device that he created has a GPS built into it.
So it says, I've blown up.
Yeah, but it records the areas that have been cleared.
Right.
What areas that it's gone through that it hasn't blown up.
Yeah.
Which is also very important to know which areas are safer than others.
Let me ask you this, Miles. Yeah, safer than others. But let me ask you something. You think there's a minefield. You put this thing and lets it roll around for a while. When do you think, it's gotten all of them? And I mean, it's still...
Well, you can't ever. And that's one of the reasons why people have been so adamant about banning landmines, especially if you're... The U.S. has gone back and forth on that. U.S. still wants to use them. But at the same time, our Army does a relatively good job
of denoting where they are.
Yeah, yeah, of tracking where they are. Like, whenever you lay them down, always saying like where they are, and then going back to try to clean them up after the conflict, which is not how most wars are fought.
Right,
and even
course.
The U.S. misses more
and,
than
and
a few.
They would. When, I mean, it's not the highest priority, of course, in war to protect the future people.
Right, yeah. But we're talking about even with the GPS tracking device that the whole thing costs maybe $40.
Cool. So landmine sweeping devices that are like tumbleweeds that roll around. Thank you, Miles. That's awesome. Alex, I was kind of excited this last couple of weeks seeing a little bit about Windows 8. When I was gone, Windows 8 got launched. And one of the things that's kind of interesting about it, I was speaking with one of the marketing people regarding it, is that it's a lot of the application infrastructure is about making web applications, HTML, HTML5, CSS, and JavaScript. And then, of course, extended into the operating system. So you're actually doing very much what Miles and I do professionally, but building native applications in Windows 8. So I was kind of excited about Windows 8. And, of course, it's one of those things where I don't think my home Windows machine has Windows 7 on it. I've played with it, but I didn't move from, I think, Vista, but it might be XP. Like, I always do things a little slower. Vista was kind of a horrible operating system. They seem to skip operating systems. Windows 7 has had good reports. I haven't heard a lot of critique on Windows 8, except the differences. You know, it's mostly
right.
About...
Well, it's really new right now, yeah. So, I mean, that's something...
Well, it's very different, but from speed aspects, apparently it's basically the same. There have been a couple of variations, but it's if you're playing games or playing or using some particular applications yeah. or the like, it's going to be about the same experience you had with Windows 7, although I heard the memory footprint was a little smaller.
So
Windows
8?
Yeah.
Windows 8, yeah.
Interesting. But yeah, if you look at, you know, the history of all the Windows releases. I actually went and pulled that up just as prep for this article, talk about this article. You know, back in 85 is when Windows 1.0 came out. Next release was 87, so you got 2 years. Then was for Windows 3.0 was in 90, which is 3 years later. Windows 3.1, again, another 3 years before the release in 93. Windows 95, so you got 2 more years.
Then actually, Windows 95 was released in 96.
Yeah, and there was also...
No, it was actually officially released in very late 95. Very late 95.
Okay, go on.
Yeah,
no,
and don't forget,
it didn't hit the stores until 96.
Right. Don't forget Windows 3.1.1 for work groups.
Yes. Oh, yeah, well, but that's I'm talking more desktop. That was you know, if you can include NT and all the
yeah,
other releases in there.
But still, Windows 3.1.1 was a
true.
You're excited about that one, Miles?
Most personal computers
awesome.
Didn't have it.
Well,
okay,
for the
so basically,
so
you're
up
looking
to 98,
every three years till you get to 1999, where they've got Windows 98 SE. So there was a 1 year release, which pretty much was sucked, and so they didn't do that. Or no, most people
no Windows 98
it.
SE was good. It was one of
Then quickly after they said, well, we need to fix some things. There's a lot of flaws with SE. They came out with ME 1 year later.
Right,
ME completely bombed. then a year later they came out with XP and people are like, okay, XP is a bit better. I still run XP in my VM.
Yeah, I use XP.
You know, I haven't bothered upgrading beyond that. Then it took 5 years for them to release Windows Vista from XP. So there's a 5 year gap where they didn't have any, you know, major.
And
they
not had, as good an operating system.
Right. Now they had their service packs is kind of how they did, but there wasn't any significant change to the system. It was more fixes.
True, but they did have like four service
well,
packs.
Well, in fairness,
of performance.
Yeah. The service packs were non-trivial.
Yeah,
they actually were.
So they were huge changes, but.
They actually had feature increases. They did add things.
Okay. So 5 years with service packs, but the same name.
Right.
Then they release Vista.
Then they release Vista. Then you know, and then 3 years later they have Windows 7, mm-hmm. and then 3 years later now we have Windows 8. So in 2012, well, they're changing that. There have been a number of leaks.
Are they talking about another operating system already?
Yeah. Oh, they're already planning on it. Yeah, they're looking at. Well, you can call it Windows 9. They may not. There's actually. What has been more or less leaked out and some anonymous reports had come out of Microsoft was that they're looking at switching to releasing every year and dropping the price from what is Windows 7, Windows 8 right now?
I don't know. I think it's a little under $100.
It's about $100, yeah. Right? But they're looking at releasing every year and shifting to a price more most likely around the $25 range.
Same as Apple.
Sounds a little bit like another company we know.
Well, it's interesting. We're seeing a lot more rapid development. I mean, the way application development is talked about now is about being nimble and changing a lot. And you see Chrome and Firefox doing extremely well and automatically updating multiple versions. I mean, I think Chrome's up to number 78 or something versions. It's like they go quick.
Yeah, well, Chrome. Yeah, Firefox also switched to that.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing is it's... I think it's just it's more easier to manage those sort of updates. You're pushing out regular updates. People updates. Are kind of getting used
to it. It really depends on the way your model works. And, you know, traditional software development, you have this giant waterfall design pattern where you take 3 years to define your spec and then you build off of that.
And that's going away now.
It's all about being agile.
Yeah, everybody's doing agile development.
So it makes sense that you have faster operating system releases. Yeah.
And if you also look, they're starting to merge their mobile device OS with their desktop OS, which again is what Apple
has been doing. Feel about that?
You know, as long as I get I don't care as long as it doesn't end up keeping me from doing what I want to do.
I'm running the most recent version of OS 10 on my laptop here, and one of the things I had to do was disable the only install stuff through Apple. There's like a feature in the system preferences that does that. Because there's some applications I want to install on my machine. And I get the reason, you know, restrict so that we know that safe stuff being installed. It seems like the next step, only do whitelist kind of installing.
I will be very unhappy if I have to jailbreak my laptop.
I have a feeling at some point you will have to jailbreak your laptop.
I don't think they'll go that far.
They might not. They might not.
I just don't see that. If
I would love an open pattern to, I mean, you know, a community-driven licensing system where it gets submitted, it gets reviewed, and it gets released by a by a group of people rather than by a corporation.
Yeah.
In the sense that you could potentially have your reasoning not based around profit, but based around
right. And you can know, still safety. Have all the benefits that that Apple
yeah, absolutely
totes with that. Yeah.
In fact, it would probably be better and faster because there'd be enough people looking at it. Works, of course, much cleaner if you have open source software.
I think we would get some really good benefits from having the general populace not have the full laptops that we have today, but going toward that Chromebook, that Chrome
lighter.
OS, that Firefox OS model.
So you like the idea of a two-tier society where you have the people that can do things, the people that can't.
I like the fact that people who don't care about computers then don't have to care about computers. The integrity of their computer.
Yes. Yeah. So what we're talking about in general is this idea that on your phone right now, the phone you have, unless you jailbreak it, you traditionally have to buy the applications and update and do everything through your service provider. And that's a traditional kind of methodology. Google's Android is a little different in some sense, but depends on your carrier. So when you want to install something on your iPhone, you have to go through Apple. The benefit of this is that everything that you install on your computer, on your phone, if you're playing by the rules, is vetted by a corporation who wants to make sure that your system's not there's no problems. So you have a little bit of protection from some outside source, making sure that someone's not writing a virus that you install intentionally. And that's really a beautiful thing on the phone space, and we've seen it get better and better such that now you can pretty much rely that your phone's only being listened to by your carrier, which is not exactly a good thing, but at least there's not a virus on your phone, most likely. The Apple is releasing their new operating system, Mountain Lion, now has that kind of idea built in where you really should be installing only through them. And to install anything else from anybody else that's not vetted by Apple and Apple doesn't get a cut from, you have to actually make a checkbox that says, I feel like I want to take on that responsibility, which of course geeks always do because we want to install our friend's software that isn't being installed through them. And also there's products like large open source products that are not through Apple and we don't really want to give Apple money. But at the same time, we're taking on a risk by saying, you know what, we don't need anybody to vet this. I can vet this myself. And of course, we're sloppy about it. So the question is, at some point, the more oversight you get on the software that goes on your computer, the safer your environment will be. And Miles' argument, I think, pretty rightly, I kind of agree with you, Miles, is that we want to make sure that a general populace does not have to be an expert on security to have a safe community
right.
experience.
And in agreement with Alex, I don't want to have to jailbreak. I want there always to be that checkbox. And if you know the checkbox is there, that's already a step to say, I know what it's going to do.
Can the checkbox be like a little 4-minute video that describes what's going on so that you understand your rights and the issues around it?
I think it's perfectly all right to have the checkbox right next to this big warning message. And then when you uncheck when you check the checkbox, have a big alert box going, all right, this could damage your computer. Yeah. Are you sure?
Yeah. And
have
it really... scares people. But
yes,
I'd like I think to be part of the setup even.
The problem that without having a better avenue for people to actually release software that's not through one of these controlled companies, you still have a problem. Let's say I write a piece of software I want to give away for free or I want to charge a little bit, but I don't want to put that through Apple's rigorous controls and you trust me or some other, my grandma wants to install my software mm-hmm. for some reason. So now she has to now go through these scary, frightening steps to just do something that I'm suggesting. It really restricts. It really gives a lot more power to the controlling vendor.
If you're having to install an app, my own personal opinion here,
yeah.
If you're having to install an app that needs permissions that extend beyond what you could have with a web browser, then if it's grandma who wants to try out your software, you can go to grandma's house and you can install it for her. Although yeah. we shouldn't be picking on grandmas because senior citizens have actually been picking up computers faster than any other segment.
Yeah.
But
yeah, yeah.
but at the same time, if by a piece of software that gets installed on your computer has rights to do basically anything.
That's the other thing that's happening on these operating systems. You start seeing a more sandbox methodology where the application has to ask, like on a phone, what kinds of things it wants to access. And then the operating system asks the user, which is, I think you and I would both agree, that's a beautiful space where the if you do have a web app kind of thing because it's a light load, mm-hmm. but you actually want to take photographs, that instead of not being able to do that, the operating system query, you know, asks grandma, hey, do you want this application to be able to use your phone or your camera? Which, of course, is a very simple question and not as scary, right? It's right. Very, very clear.
And I do like Chrome's native client API, so you're able to do some amazing things, but you are still in that sandbox.
Absolutely.
But, you know, there's just a real quick thing also, even on the Mac where they have disabled the running of applications, you can actually, if you go through and hold down Option and right-click on it and open, it actually will then run it or prompt you instead of just saying you can't.
Right.
So there is a way to do that, even, you know, and you have to know those steps in order
right.
to do it.
It's a lot of stuff you have to know, definitely. For Geek Speak, I'm Lyle Troxell. We're in the middle of the show. I want to invite the geeks to mention a geek bit. Of course, a geek bit, something you got to see to believe or something you should enjoy visually. Geeks? No? Okay, I got one. It's an ad for IE10. I don't know if you guys have seen this, but it basically, the general consensus of geeks is that Internet Explorer, Microsoft's web browser, is horrible. And it's been horrible for a long time. And since, you know, 4 or so. And we're now coming up on 10. And so the ad from Microsoft about this, about Internet Explorer 10, it's from the perspective of someone who hates Internet Explorer and puts a whole bunch of information out there. But as the person is experiencing it and derailing it through chat groups and stuff, you see that slowly the person starts to like it a little bit more. So anyway, I highly suggest it's one of the geek bits. It's a very bad stance to be a geek that has a final decision on something that then changes. Like, one of the things that we do as geeks is become very flexible about technology. We decide to move on all the time. So something we don't like in an operating system comes along, but it's the operating system everybody's using. We experience it. We figure out how to work in it. We talk about it, debate it, but we move on to the next step. Except for Internet Explorer XP, I guess. I mean, except for Windows XP, which I guess we don't move away from. But in general, to be a competent technologist, you have to embrace the most current technology. You have to keep moving forward or you get left behind. And so this idea that Internet Explorer has been horrible, hey, if Internet Explorer 10 is awesome, I'll use it. You know, it's just that's how it works.
Its feature set, I can say from compatibility tables and the like, is extremely good. Its JavaScript performance is very good. Its rendering performance for Canvas and the like is very good. Its DOM manipulation is not as fast as we'd like.
Okay.
But at the same time, I'll take that.
Yeah, that's not bad.
No, I do a bunch of DOM manipulation. Yeah. DOM document object
model. You don't do a lot of DOM.
Moving things from one place to another on a web page.
But when we're talking about DOM manipulation, the load that you're doing, are you doing it extremely a lot in one page or a little bit every once in a while?
Quite often, yeah.
But
it will affect how animations will look sometimes too.
Yeah. Oh, really? Even on Canvas or not on Canvas?
Well, Canvas, no, because Canvas, you're drawing to a pixel frame.
Right, right. So DOM animations, yeah. All right. Well, the phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. You're listening to Geek Speak here on KUSP. Last week, Robert Pauly stepped in and filled one of our episodes, Geek Speak. We'll have it up on the podcast quickly. It was a fantastic episode. And I got to say that Robert's show, Seventh Avenue Project, is one of it's superior in every way to a lot of things that I experience in the world. And I just want to say, Robert, thank you for doing that. I'm sure that anybody that hears the Geek Speak episode of yours will continue to listen to your show. So let me just make sure that everybody knows that tomorrow at noon, live on KUSP, you can listen to Robert's show. And of course, you can hear the podcast supported from KUSP through NPR, I believe. And here's tomorrow's episode. It's taken many decades, but women are finally catching up to men in the comedy business with A-list stars like Tina Fey, Amy Poehler, Sarah Silverman, and Kristen Wiig. Have women comics achieved true equality? And why did it take so long? KUSP's Robert Pauly talks to Yael Cohen about her oral history, We Killed, The Rise of Women in American Comedy. That's tomorrow at noon, Sunday at noon, here on 88.9 KUSP. You can, of course, follow us on Twitter and Facebook info@kusp.org. Shall we take one geek bit before we take the first call? Not geek bit, excuse me. News item. Let's see, where were we?
They were Miles.
Yeah, Miles, go for it.
We've covered in the past that Google is setting up fiber internet in Kansas City as a pilot project. Well, they've done so. It's gigabit in speed. And you would think, wow, gigabit to your house.
I'm drooling.
Yeah, so just a point of reference, if you have a 1 megabit connection to your house, most people have a little bit faster. You have something like a 3 or 15 or something like that.
20.
1 megabit is 1,000th. You take 1,000 of those 1 megabit connections and you have a gigabit connection.
It's fast.
It's fast. And at the same time, it's not as great as people were expecting it to be. One, you have a lot of people saying, well, I don't need that fast a speed. You know, YouTube downloads perfectly fine without that. And what is it? Netflix is like 2.3 megabits per second, something like that for a HD
download. It's a little higher than that, I think, but.
It's something like something on those lines when
HD
I was looking
not
at them.
Play well over most DSL connections.
But at the same time, when they're trying to make connections and trying to download fast, the rest of the internet and the rest of the infrastructure in the U.S. just isn't keeping up.
For gigabit, I could see that. I don't know if current speeds. I mean, you have 100 megabit. You'd probably benefit from, you know, one order of magnitude less than gigabit, but I would note, I mean, maybe not everybody, a lot of people, I'd say the majority of people probably wouldn't notice the difference between their 20 megabit cable modem connection or getting a gigabit, except for people who are downloading things. I mean, if I'm using iTunes, I go buy a movie in HD, it still takes a little while to download.
Right.
You know,
that would be instantaneous.
That would be quick. And the biggest thing that I see is, people always say, oh, I don't use that. I never use that. You know what? When you give people stuff, they use it. They end up finding ways to use it. You fill in that gap.
Yeah, if we had gigabit connections, like we would be setting up file servers in each other's homes and using that.
Huge innovations occurring. That's the problem, is not that people are looking at it, do I use it today? Have I used it before? You're not talking about the present or the past. You're talking about the future.
Yeah.
You need to open up your, give yourself room to grow in the future. And right now, we don't have it. We've been keeping ourselves limited such that we have no wiggle room to do
and, and future protection is extremely hard. So it's not something simple we can say, well, if we had this much bandwidth, we'd be doing this. I mean, yes, file transfer between our homes, of course we'd be doing, we could probably do that now. But there's stuff that we can't think of because the stuff's not been built yet. As a guess, as a futuristic failing prediction, you could talk about 3D scanning, high resolution video chat, where you put on 3D goggles to experience another person. That's going to take more bandwidth.
Even more mundane than that.
Sure.
A gigabit fiber to your home would mean that a hard drive in your laptop versus a hard drive that's
at home,
off in the cloud, or off in some service provider or something like that, would be functionally equivalent.
Right. Well, and that's my experience when I'm at the university where I work. We have, you know, 10 gigabit backbones, and it's not drenched all the time, right? So you actually have connectivity. So when I'm off and checking something even across the world, if I've got a good connection there, the activity feels just like the office. It's a very creepy experience. I was doing screen sharing, and it's fluid. It's really quite nice, assuming you're at another university as well, right, where the connection speeds are nice. Mm-hmm. But I get so used to having high bandwidth at my office that when I go home, even with a cable connection, which is pretty good, it's still kind of amazing to me that I don't even think about data transfers anymore. Right. I just do them.
Yeah. And that
would be nice if you get to that point where it's, I mean, you remember the days when you open a program and you had to wait, well, now you still do again, but you have to wait almost a minute for the program to load up, and then you would need to load that data file you're working with, and that takes another 30 seconds. We've gotten to the point now, okay, programs have
Adobe Audition, we're looking at you.
Yeah. But, you know, there's software that now you open it up, it opens much faster. You open up a file, it opens up much faster. I mean, just imagine, and the thing is now we're starting to increase our data file size. We're starting to increase the complexity and size of our program. So we're getting back, we're going backwards in terms of how long things take. But you bump that up where it's just, you open up your program and it just opens. I mean, my girlfriend will go and load up her Play Sims. And it literally takes like 5 minutes for her computer to finally get the whole thing loaded up so she can play. And I'm just looking at this in shock that right. I would lose patience and not play that game. I mean, really? No.
Yeah, I got to say, I've got my main machine now has a solid-state drive in it, and it is a completely different experience. There's just no speed problems. It's very fluid, and of course, sleep and wake up cycles extremely fast. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and speaking to your point, Alex, about infrastructure and we needing to roll out infrastructure, I'm just going to do a quick little rant.
Please.
I started doing public transit to work, and one of the things I was looking for was Wi-Fi access. Well, Caltrain doesn't have Wi-Fi.
Right. But so you're jumping on 17 Express, which has Wi-Fi, kind of.
Yeah.
Sometimes. And then you're jumping into Caltrans at...
San,
whatever that station is.
San Jose, Durden, yeah.
Yeah, Durden. And then you're going up how far on Caltrans?
Going up to the Hillsdale exit, so going up to Foster City.
So like a half an hour on the train or 20 minutes?
A half hour, I guess, is a good...
So you have an hour a day with no network? How are you surviving?
Because I'm going to be getting one of those little dongles to
cell phone service.
Right, but at the same time, I was curious about that, going, wow, they don't have it because... Highway 17 Express has it. VTA
right,
Light Rail has it.
Yeah.
And what I found out was that in 2006, they were entertaining the idea of getting Wi-Fi. And this would have been 802.11b, so 11 megabit maximum speed.
Sure.
And the reason why they didn't at the time was, one, cost millions of dollars to roll out. And they were worried that they would roll it out and there would be such great jumps in technology that it would have been obsolete in a useless investment. And if you look at straight numbers as like 802.11n, which is the current spec, even though they're looking at faster
sure.
in the future, that's a maximum of 300 megabit.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, you know, on paper, much faster, except 11 megabit is still as fast as most people's home connections.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So if they had gone forward with it, it would still be as fast as what most people have at home.
And you'd be traveling on a train.
Right.
All right. Are you going to move jobs at some point so you're actually closer to Santa Cruz?
On the contrary, it's actually working out quite well because...
Your email checks.
Just to say for employers out there, it's been a great incentive for me as an employee, is... If I can get an internet connection, for example, I get one of those dongles, USB dongles, put on my laptop, and be able to connect up to work, get onto the VPN, do the things that I need to do, communicate with people I need to communicate with, in addition to my phone, which has the internet connection
sure.
on it already, and count that as time that I am at work.
Mm-hmm. Then you can commute further.
Yeah. Then it becomes, oh, well, yes, I'm on the public transit for 2 hours.
So miles,
consider that as part of.
So the train is basically your office for half the day.
Yeah.
Miles is a Java programmer, JavaScript front-end developer, web developer, at an expert level that's rare to find, and he's currently commuting way too far. But then again,
well, no, but I mean,
that's my personal opinion. So if you want to hire him, you should contact us.
No. What does it matter though? How far it is if I'm always working there, and it doesn't take away from the time that I spend away from my family during the day.
If it's the same amount of time away from the family, sure.
Right, and I make a presence at the office where I get to interact with people, where I do have that communication level, where I do have that interaction. I think it's a great solution. I think more employers should be open to that.
So we got a call but lost the call, but the question was about security updates, and should we do 100% automated or should they be done manually? And Alex, I'd love to hear your opinion about this as a security expert, but I do want to invite people to call us with questions and comments about technology. We can take anything today. The phone number is 800-655-5877. We also have a lot of news of the week, so we can keep on going with what we've been chatting about and go on. But what do you think? If you're doing security updates, should you have be automatic and just always have it go?
You know, I think it depends on the person, really. For me, it's I let it download, I let it prepare, but it doesn't do anything until I tell it.
Mm-hmm.
I do have, you know, typically on my Mac, it'll keep pestering you. So if you ignore it, and a few days later, it'll say, "Hey, I have this thing you've been telling me to ignore."
Right.
So it keeps reminding me, and I do like that. Others, though, like my girlfriend has her Windows system when she got it was set up to do it automatically 100%.
Yeah,
and I don't know if there's a setting because I don't know Windows 7 very well. But it just, she'll be in the middle of playing her game, and all of a sudden it just shuts down on her in the middle of her game.
Because it's updated.
You know, or whatever she's doing. Yeah, because the computer just decides, I'm going to run an update. And she says she doesn't get any prompts or anything. I'm like, I don't like that. That's a little too extreme.
Yeah, but at the same time, you wouldn't want someone to ignoring those prompts for a period of time.
True.
I mean, the reason, okay, so
well,
the reason
if they
that
keep
you,
pestering you,
yeah, Alex,
you know, at least they know.
The reason why you don't do it automatically, not that the Mac will automatically shut down, but I mean, it potentially could, but
could.
The reason why you don't do it automatically is sometimes there's a release that actually causes a problem, right? That happens every once
That's
in a while.
That's never really my motivation. I mean, yeah, that happens, but my reasoning is I'm usually in the middle of something. Sometimes there are certain updates that require a reboot, and I don't want to have to reboot all the
for
time.
For some reason, my laptop at one point got into wanting to do the updates at about 9:40 on Saturday mornings. We go on air at 10. Not the best choice for me to have my machine change. So I always do it manually from that point on. And I think it still prompts me before GeekSpeak if there's an update. But the point for me is I always kind of take a look. I always read the description of what they're updating, of course, because I want to know so that I can inform people if something major has happened. Like Java is very different now, and the way the operating systems are handling it is different now, and the ways the browsers are handling it are different now. And I kind of know that because the updates flew in, and I knew when my machine changed, and it wasn't enough information, and not, I don't think it's interesting enough to everybody. That's why we didn't talk about it, but it's definitely something I want to keep abreast of. Anyway, Mike from Salinas did call back. So, Mike, you've heard this conversation. Did we answer your question?
Yeah, I just had three points to make. I promise I'll be very quick. On the tip about security, I was telling your call screen is that I always have always felt like there's the biggest security hole of all is the end user across the board, and you have to have good educated end users to have perfect security, which is never going to happen. The second point I was going to say with software updates, you can either make them completely compulsory and opaque and have some of the problems like you guys were addressing, or you can make and ensure security, but also if you do that, you end up frustrating power users and people who have the savvy to decide whether or not they're going to apply this update now or later or so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And the third point that I wanted to make, I completely slipped my mind.
Well, let me address the automatic update. No one even knows. That's happening in the browsers at this point, right? So if you have got Chrome or Firefox, the most updated one, you actually, by default, have no control of whether it's updating or not. It's just doing it for you, which I think for a browser is a really good idea, assuming that they test the heck out of it. Because at some point, someone's going to make a release that will break, most likely, and break the auto update. See, and everyone will fail to use Chrome for a while or something. They're being careful. But I like that update because I see, you know, we see the security flaws in this space.
Yeah. No, I completely agree. But to me, I'm fine with an automatic update as long as it does not interfere with the ability for me to do what I'm doing.
Yes. Yes.
That is the
And
key.
I think
if
that the browsers are doing a good job of that.
That's good.
That's right. The other thing about the browsers doing it that I think is different than most other things is that if I'm using Photoshop and it automatically updates and there's a problem, I no longer have that application at all. Same thing with Lightroom, which I rely on very much for my photo management. I do not want that auto-updating. I want to control when I do that. It's very important. My browsers, which connect to the internet all the time, I happen to have three of them that I use, and I bounce around. If one of them breaks in an update, that's cool. I can handle that. You know, my bookmarks might not be as easy, whatever, but it's not like a complete loss of a service. And so I think that's why I'm so comfortable with the browser. Additionally, the browser is really interacting with the web, which, of course, is a free-for-all of problems.
Yeah,
but we are atypical. We are not normal
I agree.
End users. Most end users don't have the capacity to do that.
I think that the Windows automatically updating in the background and shutting down your machine is horrible, and I'm sure they don't do that in the more recent versions.
It should restart. That's the biggest to me.
It should prompt and say, when you can restart, please do, because updates happen.
Yeah,
it's a good idea.
And nag it. Fine.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's just
but
don't
assuming
take away
that kind of problem, and assuming they do a good job of not breaking the system in general with an automatic update, I think it's because I think that what's happened over the years is that updates have been so painful that people don't want to deal with them.
Yeah, but
so
I think that's reducing now. People should
agree.
Be able to trust them a lot more
I agree.
Nowadays.
But having the interaction aspect of it is just asking, do you want to have a hassle potentially? That's really what's going on for most users, right? Oh, I don't want to have a hassle. And so they say no. So I kind of like, let's get rid of the hassle, but let's also just not even prompt the user an update. At the same time, there's another problem that emerges really drastically. When you have a system that automatically updates without your awareness, things can change that potentially insert vulnerabilities. There's always a security problem potential. So now your question is, do I trust the entire stack to automatically update and everything be fine for me? And that's once
See,
you get
the,
one kind of little problem in there, you no longer have control of your computer.
Yes and no. Updates almost always fix things.
Yes, but you're assuming that update is valid.
They may introduce new vulnerabilities, but they're not going to be known yet.
Yes.
And as an end user, you don't have the knowledge or the expertise or usually the time to do the research.
What
to know,
I'm
so
saying,
they should just be able to.
What I'm saying, Alex, is if I have an operating system that auto updates And for some reason, the security flaw exists between me and the auto updating service of Apple, but I trust it. I'm all of a sudden have a prominent, you know, root user access to my machine that I have no interaction with. And if there's any flaw in that stack, my machine is no longer mine anymore. So that's the concern I have. Now, I trust
think it
that
should be an option. That's yeah, the biggest thing to me. As a power user, I should be able to change that setting.
Mike, is that enough information from us?
Yeah, and the last thing I wanted to throw out is kind of a more philosophical tip. The average end user has very low computer savvy in general, and my friends and I, all fellow system administrators, have kind of bandied about the notion that maybe that might be because entities like Microsoft for so many years have been selling their products with, you know, it's so easy, you don't have to know anything, it just works for you automatically, and it does everything automatically. And that has encouraged people to not learn how to use their computers and not voluntarily not develop any savvy, because they automatically assume that everything is automatic and it's so simple and it's so easy. Obviously, we don't really have anything to support this scientifically, but I was curious on your guys' thoughts.
There was actually a saying many years ago among Unix and Nobel administrators, where they would, with regard to Windows NT when it was coming out, that was the big push that Microsoft had to go into the server market,
mm-hmm.
Which was, if any idiot can administer a server, any idiot will.
Right.
And
so you're
that
saying
became an issue of that same thing that the caller was talking about, which is
Mike,
if anyone considers it really easy to do something and just has a GUI, this is how it works, and anyone can just click a couple of buttons, then anyone who is only capable of clicking a couple of buttons
can
will
do
then
that. Well, I think Mike's question in general about, you know, have we set up a situation where we strive to have the least knowledge possible about computers, and that's the idea. But I got to say,
I don't disagree with that approach, though. To me, using a computer is not about using a computer unless you're a geek. Using a computer is about doing the task you want to do.
I always relate it to cars. I know how a car works. I know a lot about cars. I don't want to work on my cars, right? I'm not interested. And if my car breaks down, it's not, ooh, cool discovery about how and why. No, it's, I want my car working again. Here's some money. Because it's just not my interest area. Mm-hmm. And just because geeks find computers fascinating, and when they break it, they go, ooh, well, was it a virus or what happened? Oh, my hard drive failed. Oh, cool. And then we talk about it and all that experience. That is not what I think most people should be doing with computers. I think relying on them and to be stable and useful is probably the thing we should be striving
for. For the desktops, that's definitely the case. I guess the anecdote I was trying to say was more for the person that you're paying money to fix it should be someone who has a greater knowledge level than the average user.
Right. Well, we've got, I think we're going to go ahead and go to Monterey. We're going to talk to Rick. Rick, welcome to Geek Speak. What's your question?
Thanks. The question is, and thanks for this service, even though I really appreciate it, even though often I find smoke coming out of my ears when I look in the mirror after one of these, but frying my brain with wonderful information. But I'll tell you, one of the questions is about these, you know, like Dropbox and YouSendIt, the ways to transfer information when there's too much for an email.
Yeah.
Attachment.
Sure.
And most people that I work with seem to be using YouSendIt, and I often have to send multiple files, and somehow YouSendIt, the machine seemed to talk me into spending like $15 a month, which I'm now doing, even though I don't do it very often. And then there are other people who do this all the time, and they
Dropbox,
I do it for free.
Right, yeah, so Dropbox definitely has a free area, and it really has to do with how much storage you have in it. So if you start deleting stuff, you can use the free space more. I mean, it's basically, that's it.
What I was trying to do was to move a whole folder in instead of, like, moving one file and sending that file in it, because I had, like, 20 files to send.
And then you run out of space. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a really interesting question of how much you want your data in the cloud and how much you want to pay for that convenience.
I don't need to leave it there very often.
Right.
For very long.
Another thing you can do in Dropbox is you can actually make an alias to a folder in Dropbox, and that will propagate over. So you don't have to actually move your file system over. You can actually kind of make a shortcut in that space. There's instructions on that drop site. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. Thanks so much for the call.
Oh, appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Dropbox is a ability to put a file on the online and then share it between people, including yourself. And you can send an email saying this file is up there so that your email doesn't fail.
Which would be awesome if you had a gigabit connection to your house.
Of course. Celebrating 40 years together, this is 88.9 KUSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kusp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used with permission. Please don't forget to check out Robert Pauley's amazing show, 7th Avenue Project, tomorrow, Sunday at noon, or of course, from KUSP.org. You can find it as well. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me today was Miles Elam. He's a programmer and political analyst and junkie. Hi, thanks for being here.
Always a pleasure.
And Alex Liest, our security expert from down south. Thanks for coming up to do the show with us today. And
thank
enjoy.
It was a pleasure to do.
I hope you have great wine tasting throughout the
week. Oh, I plan on it.
Great. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz. I'm Lyle Troxell. See you next week.